5. Going round the bend. Whispers reflected from a giant hemispherical ceiling were described by Wallace Sabine, the grandfather of architectural acoustics, as the effect of an invisible and mocking presence. In the huge dome of the Gol Gumbaz Mausoleum in India, the footfall of a single individual is enough to wake the sounds as of a company of persons, reported the celebrated physicist C.V. Raman, and a single loud clap is distinctly echoed 10 times. When I was in the sewer, listen to the prologue, my speech appeared to hug the walls of the tunnel, spiraling around the inside of the curve as the sound slowly died away. Some of the strangest sound effects can be created by simple concave surfaces. In 1824, naval officer Edward Boyd described how a curve can dramatically amplify sound, and not always for the best. He wrote in the Cathedral of Girgenta in Sicily, "The slightest whisper is borne with perfect distinctness from the great western door to the cornice behind the high altar, a distance of 250 feet. Unfortunately, the confessional was badly sighted. Secrets never intended for the public ear thus became known, to the dismay of the confessors, and the scandal of the people, till at length, one listener having had his curiosity somewhat overgratified by hearing his wife's avowal of her own infidelity, this tell-tale peculiarity became generally known, and the confessional was removed." For centuries, people have known that curved surfaces amplify sounds and allow covert listening. Athanasius Kircher gave a good explanation in the 17th century. We met Kircher in Chapter 4 because he wrote extensively on echoes. His publications also document some fantastical devices, including giant ear trumpets built into the walls of royal chambers for eavesdropping. Probably his most famous or infamous device is the Katzenklavier, literally, cat piano. It has a normal piano keyboard in front of a line of cages, each of which has a cat trapped inside. Every time a piano key is pressed, a nail is driven into the tail of one unfortunate feline, which naturally screeches. With the right set of cats, ones that shriek at different frequencies, a sadistic musician could play a tune on the instrument. The sound would have been excruciating, but then it was designed to shock psychiatric patients into changing their behavior, rather than being a genuine instrument for playing Monteverdi or Purcell. Fortunately, it is unlikely that it was ever built. At this point, you might be doubting the sanity and rationality of Kircher. Yet he drew diagrams that illustrated a good scientific understanding of how an elliptical ceiling can enhance communication between two people. The lines between the speaker and the listener show the path that sound rays take. These ray paths can be worked out using a ruler and protractor. Alternatively, by treating the room as a weird-shaped pool table, the paths can be worked out by following the line a cue ball would take, ignoring gravity. If the cue ball is placed at the speaker's mouth and fired toward the ceiling, it will always go to the listener. So all the sound going upward is focused at the listener, allowing even quiet whispers to be heard across a large room. The problem with this design is that the listener and speaker have to stand in particular places, the foci of the ceiling ellipse. The design is not very useful if one person wants to talk to an audience of listeners scattered around the room. In 1935, the Finnish modernist architect Alvar Aalto tried to overcome this problem using a wavy ceiling for the Viipuri Library. Originally, the library was in Finland, but the town of Viipuri was subsumed into the Soviet Union after the Second World War. From the speaker's podium at one end of the room, the ceiling looks like gentle, undulating waves coming in from the sea. The wave troughs form concave curves, each designed to amplify the sound for particular listeners. Unfortunately, each wave crest also reflects sound back toward the talker, weakening the strength of the reflections to the back of the room and making it harder for those at the rear to hear the speaker. In reality, using curved focusing ceilings to improve communication in a room rarely works as intended. Elliptical ceilings work rather like a shaving mirror, a simple curved reflective surface that brings light rays together to a point. Both the ceiling and shaving mirror achieve magnification, But whereas for light the result is a bigger image, for sound the result is increased loudness. In the shaving mirror, the reflections that meet your eyes are distorted so that you can see an enlarged picture of your face. But with hearing, the reflections coming from different parts of the ceiling add together at the entrance of the ear canals and are treated holistically by the brain. The overall effect is a louder sound, which can make distant objects appear closer than they really are. In Elements of Physics, 1827, Neil Arnott writes, "The widespread sail of a ship, rendered concave by a gentle breeze, is a good collector of sound. It happened once on board a ship sailing along the coast of Brazil, far out of sight of land, that the persons walking on deck, when passing a particular spot, always heard very distinctly the sound of bells, varying as in human rejoicings. All on board came to listen and were convinced, but the phenomenon was most mysterious. Months afterwards it was ascertained that, at the time of observation, the bells of the city of Salvador on the Brazilian coast had been ringing on the occasion of a festival. Their sound, therefore, favoured by a gentle wind, had travelled 100 miles, 160 kilometres by smooth water, and had been brought to a focus by the sail on the particular spot where it was listened to. Is this story true? Can an acoustic mirror pick up bells 100 miles away? One way to answer this question is to look at some more modern examples. Just south of Manchester in England stands the gigantic dish of the Lovell telescope at Jodrell Bank Observatory. This telescope uses the same process of focusing to collect and magnify radio waves, and in the past it played an important role in the space race. When the Soviet probe Luna 9 surprised the West by landing on the moon in 1966, the observatory intercepted the spacecraft's transmissions. Feeding the signal into a fax machine revealed pictures of the lunar surface that were then first published in a British newspaper before they appeared in the Soviet Union. Two whispering dishes stand in the shadow of the giant telescope. There are other, similar whispering dishes at other science museums and sculpture parks. The last time I visited, my teenage sons entertained themselves by whispering insults at each other using the dishes. The mirrors are 25 meters, 80 feet apart, yet the sniping siblings were very loud. But Arnott's sailing ship was much farther from Salvador than a few tens of meters. Around the coast of England are remnants of acoustic mirrors designed to work over relatively long distances. These are large, ugly concrete bowls, typically 4 to 5 meters, 13 to 16 feet in diameter, which face the sea. Built in the early 20th century, they were intended as an early warning system for enemy aircraft. Most are bowl-shaped, but in Denge, Kent, there is also a vast, sweeping arc of discoloured concrete. The arc is 5 meters, 16 feet high, and 60 meters, 200 feet wide, the equivalent of about 5 double-decker buses parked end to end. It is curved both horizontally and vertically to magnify the engine noise from approaching aircraft. Military tests showed that the large strip mirror could detect aircraft 32 kilometers, 20 miles away, when enemy planes were roughly a third of the way across the English Channel. But in poor weather conditions, aircraft might get within 10 kilometers, 6 miles before detection, and listeners struggle to hear planes with quieter engines. Even on a good day, these acoustic mirrors provided a measly 10 minutes of extra early warning. Once a working radar system was developed in 1937, the plan to build an extensive network of mirrors was dropped. The short detection ranges of the concrete acoustic mirrors makes the claim of a ship sail focusing sounds from a festival 100 miles away seem fanciful. But a catastrophic event several years ago in England hints at an explanation. In December 2005, an overflowing storage tank caused a giant explosion at the Buncefield oil terminal in the UK and shook glass doors in Belgium 270 kilometres, 170 miles away. This was one of the biggest explosions in peacetime Europe, measuring 2.4 on the Richter scale. Although the bang at Buncefield must have been very powerful, the initial loudness alone does not explain the huge distances the noise carried. The catastrophe happened on a still, clear and frosty morning, when a layer of cold air was trapped close to the ground by warm air above. Without this temperature inversion, the Belgians would have been left undisturbed. When the oil refinery blew up, sound waves would have been sent out in all directions, rather like the ripples created when a rock is lobbed into a pond. Much of the noise would have headed upward toward the heavens and, under normal conditions, would never have been heard again. But with the temperature inversion, the sound heading upward was refracted back down to Earth and could be heard far away. Intriguingly, Arnott's story of the sailing ship mentions the weather as being a crucial part of the tale. The report might well be correct if a temperature inversion helps direct sound to the concave sail. A few years ago, I presented two science shows at the Royal Albert Hall in London to thousands of children. Though better known as a music venue, the hall is actually dedicated to the promotion of art and science, and it was built on land purchased with the profits of the Great Exhibition of 1851. For an amateur performer like me, a complex science show is a daunting challenge, made all the worse in this case by the vastness of the arena. Fortunately, the acoustics have been significantly improved since the hall opened 130 years ago. Indeed, the Prince of Wales struggled with his opening speech. According to the Times, 1871, the address was slowly and distinctly read by His Royal Highness, but the reading was somewhat marred by an echo which seemed to be suddenly awoke from the organ or picture gallery, and repeated the words with a mocking emphasis which at another time would have been amusing. The hall's ubiquitous curved surfaces are probably what caused the mocking echoes. From above, the floor plan appears as an ellipse, and the whole structure is topped with a large dome. The curved surfaces focus sound like Kircher's elliptical ceiling. But how such reflections are perceived depends on the size of the room. In the vast Royal Albert Hall, the curves cause disastrous echoes. Sound appears to come from several places in the room and not just the stage. In a small room, the focused sound arrives quickly. In a larger room, the reflections are delayed. You can test this phenomenon out with a friend. Find a large open area with one big reflecting wall, such as a large building at the side of a park or the side of a quarry. A quiet place away from noise is best. For the exercise to work, you need to hear the sound bouncing off the wall with few reflections from other surfaces. The wall does not need to be curved if it is large enough. If you and your friend stand some distance apart, but each of you is the same distance from the wall, then the effect is more obvious. The test would work particularly well on a snowy day, when the sound reflecting from the ground would be absorbed by the snow and all traffic would have ground to a halt. Walk toward the wall while chatting with your friend, and at some point you will become aware of the reflection from the building. As you get closer, you will hear the echo from the wall becoming louder because the reflection has traveled a shorter distance. But then, as you approach even nearer, starting about 17 meters, 56 feet away, the sound of the reflection will appear to gradually get quieter until, at about 8 meters, 26 feet from the wall, it appears to disappear altogether. It is still there, but it is no longer being heard separately. Your brain has combined it with the sound traveling directly in a straight line from your friend. The way the brain combines sounds is important, because otherwise we would rapidly become overwhelmed by the vast number of reflections that accompany us. As I type this sentence, the rattle of the keyboard is being reflected off the desk, the computer monitor, my phone, the ceiling, and so on. Yet my hearing is not overwhelmed by all these different reflections. The sound still appears to be coming straight from the keyboard as it should be. The same thing happens in Kircher's small room. The reflections from the elliptical ceiling arrive quite quickly, and unless the reflections are very loud, the brain does not hear them as separate from sound traveling directly between talker and listener. By contrast, the Royal Albert Hall is so vast that the focused reflections arrive much later, creating mocking echoes. Acoustic engineers made various attempts to remove the echoes from the Royal Albert Hall. The most successful solution was to add the mushrooms hanging from the ceiling. Originally installed in 1968, following an idea by Ken Shearer of the BBC. These large discs hang down at the base of the dome and reflect sound away from it. Although it is no longer possible to appreciate, or not, the echo from the hall's ceiling, there are plenty of other domes to explore. A few miles from my home, for example, is Manchester Central Library, which has a great dome with a focal point that used to be close to the microfiche machines. Every time a glass plate fell to cover the microfiche, a startlingly loud echo resounded from the ceiling. The library is currently closed for renovation. One hopes that the building work will not be as sonically unsympathetic as the renovation of the US Capitol in the 19th century in Washington, D.C., which ruined a fine ceiling echo from a famous whispering dome. The Capitol's dome used to be an almost perfect hemisphere, centered at the head height of visitors, and although the ceiling appeared coffered with indented squares, it was actually smooth, with trompe-l'œil painting creating the illusion of structure and texture. Before 1901, this domed space was a great draw for tourists. According to the New York Times in 1894, the Whispering Gallery still holds the palm among the showplaces of the great marble structure. Once in a while, an old resident of Washington is initiated into the mysteries of the echoes and other acoustic phenomena which abound in this old-time chamber, and he feels a little ashamed of his tardiness in seeking this remarkable entertainment. But while it was great fun for the tourists, it was a poor place for the House of Representatives to hold debates. As the Lewiston Daily Sun put it in 1893, the orator who was not cautious enough to remain in one spot during the delivery of his address found the acoustics of the hall taking strange liberties with his elocution, transforming his crescendo sentences into comical squeals, or causing his pianissimo phrases, his stage whispers, to shriek and wail as he moved to and fro from one echo point to another. A gas explosion and fire in 1898 elsewhere in the building led to replacement of the wooden dome by a fireproof construction. Real plaster coffers were installed in place of the trompe-l'œil, making the effect of the focus weaker and less remarkable. As the eminent acoustician Lothar Kremer remarked, to everyone's dismay, the famous focusing effect was remarkably reduced, since the precise geometric reflection had been supplanted by a fuzzier diffuse reflection. Changing from a smooth surface to one covered in lumps and bumps is rather like taking a perfect optical mirror and scratching it badly or adding a frosting. The irregularities of the surface cause the light or sound to be scattered away from the focal point. For an optical mirror, the result is a fuzzy image. For the Capitol's dome, this scattering weakens the sound reflections, so whispers are no longer remarkably loud and voices are less distorted. The effect of the coffers on the Capitol's focus reminds me of an engineering project I worked on a few years ago. I designed diffusing surfaces for the large circular Rasmussen Theatre at the National Museum of the American Indian in Washington, D.C. To keep the curves from causing focusing and creating mocking echoes, I designed a bumpy surface that, like the coffers in the Capitol's dome, scattered sound in all directions away from the focal points. A cross-section through the diffuser looked like a city skyline. As sound waves meet the diffuser, the irregular heights of the blocks force the reflections to go off in different directions. My innovation was coming up with a way of determining where to place these skyscrapers and how high to make them. I used a trial and error process in which a computer program tries out many different skylines. For each configuration, the program predicts how sound will reflect from the surface and evaluates whether the focus for the curved surface will be removed. The program keeps rearranging the skyscrapers until a good design is found. This iterative process, known as numerical optimization, has been used in many branches of engineering, including designing parts for the space shuttle. One of the reasons this method is so powerful for acoustic diffusers is that it allows surfaces to be designed that fit the visual appearance of the room. The acoustic treatments do not have to look like ugly add-ons. Curves, skylines, pyramids, whatever shape the architect desires, the method can be tasked with finding features that have the best acoustic performance. The great thing about a dome is that if you stand right under the center and clap your hands, you will be deafened a moment later by the echo of your hands clapping. If you say, in mock horror, "A handbag?" you will hear the echo of Dame Edith Evans a second later from the heavens. This is the journalist Miles Kington encouraging you to unleash your inner Lady Bracknell from The Importance of Being Earnest by Oscar Wilde. But while domes are fun, a completely spherical room is even better because reflections are amplified even more. The Maparium in Boston is a 9-meter diameter, 30-foot sphere and was built in 1935 following a suggestion by architect Chester Lindsay Churchill. It is a giant hollow globe of the world, with the seas and continents vividly drawn on stained glass. It took 8 months to paint and bake all 608 glass panels, which are mounted on a spherical bronze frame. Visitors traverse a walkway cutting through the center of the Earth, linking up two opposite points on the equator. 300 light bulbs illuminate the globe from the outside. Looking at the world from the inside out is an odd experience, but what also strikes visitors are the strange acoustics, which were an accidental byproduct of the geometry. William Hartman from Michigan State University and colleagues documented the various illusions that can be heard. Usually, moving farther away from a listener makes a talker's voice quieter, but that's not always the case in a spherical room. Imagine, Hartman writes, you are on the Maparium Bridge, 2 meters, about 7 feet to the left of dead center. Your friend is exactly at the center and is talking to you. His voice seems rather quiet. Now your friend walks away from you, and his voice gets louder and louder until he is about 2 meters to the right of dead center. When the talker speaks from the center, all the reflections are focused back, so the talker appears to be surprisingly quiet to the listener left of center. If the talker moves to the right, then the place where the reflections focus moves closer to the listener. The sound will be the loudest when the talker and listener are arranged symmetrically about the center. Although this effect is particularly strong in the Maparium, which has curved surfaces above, below, and in front of the speaker, given the right structures it can even be heard outdoors, as reported by José Sánchez de Hisa from the Polytechnic University of Valencia in Spain. The Zempoala archaeological site near Veracruz in Mexico is one of the most complete surviving examples of an Aztec ceremonial center. It is a large grass plaza dotted with the remains of various structures, including a low circular enclosure topped with merlons. The guidebook hedges its bets about the purpose of the structure. Associated with gladiator worship of Mexican, Aztec origin, although it may have served as an intake for rainwater. In pictures, the structure looks like a stone sheep enclosure made of large round pebbles. Whatever the purpose of the circle, it displays an acoustic focus. Sánchez de Hisa reports that if a listener stands in the right place, while a companion walks and talks along a diagonal through the circle, the sound gets louder as the speaker moves farther away. Hoping to visit a spherical room, I sought out urban explorers, people who like to illicitly explore sewers, abandoned subway stations, and derelict buildings, enjoying the visceral thrill of trespassing in ghostly places where others do not go, and finding hidden histories and traces of previous occupants. One member of Subterranea Britannica, a group dedicated to the legitimate exploration of underground spaces in the UK, sent me an email describing a dome in Berlin that was one of the most important listening stations for the West during the Cold War. The enclosed photo showed the dome on top of a derelict tower. This was a place I had to visit. The abandoned spy station sits atop Teufelsberg, Devil's Mountain, which rises up from the Grunewald Forest. As I walked up through the woods on a hot summer's day toward the listening station, it seemed unbelievable that this large hill was man-made. It was constructed from millions of cubic yards of rubble created by bombing raids and artillery bombardments during World War II. Before entering, I had to sign a liability waiver because the derelict buildings have many holes and missing walls with no protection from the sheer drops below. My German tour guide was Martin Schaefert, A young history scholar sporting a neat beard, small ponytail, glasses and a flat cap. As Martin explained the history of the site, I surveyed what remained of the buildings. Doors and walls were missing, with the debris of the crumbling buildings lying on the floor mixed with broken glass from semi-illicit parties. Where walls were intact, they were covered in graffiti. My eye was drawn upward, where on top of the main building were three domes. Some were vandalized, with their walls partly in tatters, but the topmost one, sitting on top of a five-story tower rising out of the roof, was intact. These were radomes, a contraction of the words radar and domes, used to hide the spying activities from prying eyes as the British and Americans listened in on broadcasts and wireless communications from East Germany, Czechoslovakia, and the Soviet Union. The spherical domes were also used to protect the listening equipment from the elements, especially wind and ice. All that remains now are the concrete plinths to which the antennae were bolted. The domes were constructed of triangular and hexagonal fiberglass panels stretched between a scaffold, looking like giant soccer balls. Fiberglass is transparent to electromagnetic waves and so ideal for radomes. This was one of the reasons the material was developed during World War II. The tower supporting the top dome was missing all its walls, but the dome itself was virtually complete because it had been rebuilt and reused for air traffic control over Berlin. Every surface of the dingy stairwell up the center of the tower was coated in graffiti. As I climbed the stairs to the dome, I could hear the reverberated voices of other visitors enjoying the acoustics. With a mid-frequency reverberation time of about 8 seconds, the radome sounds a bit like a cathedral. Musicians come to perform music in the space, but there is more to enjoy than just the reverberance. Once inside, I stood and watched other visitors. It was wonderful to see their faces light up when they realized how odd the acoustic was. The slightest sound, even a simple footstep, created a ricocheting effect. Some were prompted to explore with gusto. A good hard stomp could be heard to repeat 8 times, sounding like distant firecrackers, while most contented themselves to playing more subtly, almost treating the space with the same reverence as they would a place of worship. I then climbed onto the old antenna plinth to get to the center of the room. The dome is roughly the top 2/3 of a sphere about 15 meters, 50 feet in diameter, constructed from yellowing hexagons. A band of graffiti 2 meters, about 7 feet high, ran above the floor, interrupted only by a second small opening, through which was an unprotected sheer drop to the roof of the building 5 stories below. I got out my recorder to dictate my impressions of the place, and noticed how every word was doubled up by the reflections from the radome. Here in Teufelsberg, I wanted to explore an effect that happens in the spherical maparium. The unusually strong focus makes it possible to experience the strange sensation of whispering into your own ear. Or as Hartmann puts it, as you approach the exact center of the maparium sphere, you suddenly become aware of strong reflections of your own voice. If you sway to the left, you hear yourself in your right ear. If you sway to the right, you hear yourself in your left ear. In Teufelsberg, the effect is strongest if you look upward while whispering, because there is a larger concave area to focus the sound. Thus, with my head tilted backward, 5 stories up in a fiberglass radome in Berlin, I discovered an exciting binaural sonic wonder, an effect that reveals how we work out where sound is coming from. Having 2 ears enables mammals to perceive the locations of sound sources. Hearing evolved to enable animals to sense danger, alerting them to predators sneaking up and trying to turn them into lunch. Humans have good vision, but our eyesight cannot detect threats from behind, so being able to hear and locate danger is crucial. There are a couple of main ways in which we sense where sound is coming from. Imagine that someone is talking to you from your left side. The sound arrives first at your left ear because it takes slightly longer to reach your right ear. Your brain also makes fine distinctions in loudness. The sound has to bend around your head to reach the right ear, causing it to be much quieter at high frequency. The loudness of low frequencies coming from far away is minimally affected by your head itself. Your brain compares the timing in each ear at low frequency and the relative level of high frequencies to decide where the sound is coming from. Spherical rooms can mess with both of these cues. The loudness cue can be distorted, creating an unexpected localization. It makes sound appear to come from the wrong direction, as Hartman describes. Suppose you are on the Maparian Bridge facing South America. There is a source of noise to your right, but you discover that you hear the noise coming from your left. Strong, focused reflections from the sphere create a loud reflection at the left ear, fooling the brain into localizing the noise on the left side. Localization is usually based on the first sound arriving at the ears, the precedence effect. This rule of thumb serves us well because the earliest sound takes the quickest route, which is usually a straight line between talker and listener. You may have sat through a church service in which the sermon appeared to be delivered by the loudspeakers rather than by the preacher. The reason for this impression is that the sound from the loudspeakers reaches the listener first. Adding a little delay electronically in the public address system, so that the first sound wave to reach the listener comes directly from the preacher's lips, solves this problem. But adding a delay is ineffective if the loudspeakers are turned up too high, because the precedence effect can be overruled by a loud sound that arrives later, a situation that prevails at most rock concerts. Without electronic amplification, though, reflections from walls are usually too quiet to cause a problem. But in the case of the Maparium or Teufelsberg, where the dome's focus greatly amplifies the delayed sound, the reflections are so strong that we are fooled by false localization. When I burst my balloons in Teufelsberg, the first reflection from the ceiling was 11 decibels louder than the sound coming directly from the balloon. A useful guide is that an increase in 10 decibels is roughly a doubling in perceived loudness. When I knelt down to unzip my knapsack, it sounded like someone was opening the bag above my head. Barry Marshall, from the New England Institute of Art in Brookline, Massachusetts, who used to be a guide at the Maparium, told me how he used the acoustic to play practical jokes on visitors and blow their minds. The strong focus meant that he could stand far away from visitors and surprise them by calling, "Over here," and they would look in the wrong direction. In Teufelsberg, I contented myself with spying on other conversations by finding the point where the speech of other visitors was being focused. Long-distance whispering and sound focusing tend to unnerve people because they hear something that seems supernatural. If I were to chat with you in a normal room, the low frequencies in my voice would have roughly the same loudness in both your ears, whichever way you faced, because they can easily bend around your head by diffraction. Normally, low frequencies become much louder in just one of your ears only if I get very close, maximizing the sound shadow cast by the head. The effect reduces low frequencies in the far ear, making you think I'm next to you. But in the Maparium, the sphere can focus sound so intensely on one ear that it can trick the brain into thinking that I must be close by. Not only can I whisper sweet nothings to a loved one yards away, I can even narcissistically whisper them to myself. The point of whispering, of course, is to say something so quietly that unintended listeners cannot hear it. Apparently, the original dome of the Capitol allowed members of the House of Representatives to whisper private messages to each other. But the amplification worked both ways. The congressmen could also overhear their colleagues' secrets. We naturally seem to associate sound amplification by curves with spying, subterfuge, or illicit liaisons. Fellini used this link to dramatic effect in his film La Dolce Vita, in which a concave basin allows eavesdropping on conversations from the lower floor of a villa. But the most curious spying legend concerns a large limestone cave near Syracuse in Sicily, called the Ear of Dionysius. The story goes that the tyrant Dionysius, circa 430 to 367 BC, used the cave as a prison and exploited the acoustics to find out what hapless detainees were whispering to each other. The cavern is shaped like a tall, pointy donkey's ear and narrows dramatically at the top. The wedge shape acts like a funnel to sound, potentially collecting whispers from the ground level and concentrating them at the roof of the cave, 22 meters, 72 feet above. Legend has it that Dionysius spied on prisoners from a listening chamber at the top, picking up the amplified sound through a small hidden opening at the top of the cavern. The cave is a popular tourist venue, and in the past, the listening chamber could be visited, as one traveller noted in 1842, the only mode of access being by means of a rope and pulley, the adventurer hazarding his life in a little crazy chair. Despite the legend being recounted to tourists, some reports cast doubt on whether spying was possible. In 1820, the Reverend Thomas Hughes wrote, "A very low whisper is heard only as an indistinct murmur. The full voice is drowned in the confusion of the echoes. The voices of several persons speaking at the same time are as unintelligible as the cackling of geese, so that if the ancient Sicilians were half as loquacious as the modern, who always chatter in concert, they must very often have put the listening tyrant to a nonplus. With modern health and safety precautions, visitors can no longer enter the upper chamber. A listener today is simply left to enjoy the reverberation at ground level, marvel at the legend, and gaze at the cavern's large, ear-like shape. A different sound-related tradition that has been stopped is the firing of firearms for tourists. According to another 19th-century visitor, a pistol was fired, and the report was like the discharge of an 8-and-40-pounder. Recently, Gino Iannacci from the Second University of Naples and collaborators persuaded the cave owners to let them into the listening chamber to survey the acoustic. Just as my team rates theatres, classrooms, and railway stations, Iannacci's group took a battery of measurements to assess speech intelligibility in the cave. The results were on the bad side of average, indicating that the cave's reverberation makes speech muddy and incomprehensible. Undeterred, Iannacci then carried out a series of perceptual tests, asking listeners to transcribe phrases recounted in the cave, but nobody could get a single word right. Disappointingly, the scientific measurements failed to support the legend. Utterly overcome by pain and grief, I crouched against the granite wall. I just commenced to feel the fainting coming on again, and the sensation that this was the last struggle before complete annihilation. When, on a sudden, a violent uproar reached my ears. It had some resemblance to the prolonged rumbling voice of thunder, and I clearly distinguished sonorous voices, lost one after the other in the distant depths of the gulf. Suddenly my ear, which leaned accidentally against the wall, appeared to catch, as it were, the faintest echo of a sound. I thought that I heard vague, incoherent, and distant voices. I quivered all over with excitement and hope. "It must be hallucination," I cried. "It cannot be. It is not true." But no, by listening more attentively, I really did convince myself that what I heard was truly the sound of human voices. This is the moment at which Professor Hardwick and Harry, the heroes of Jules Verne's A Journey to the Center of the Earth, miraculously reconnect via a whispering wall formed from a granite labyrinth. It is a prodigious structure, and Harry works out that he is hearing Hardwick 8 kilometers, 5 miles away. Outside Jules Verne's imagination and above ground, the largest real whispering wall I know of is 140 meters, 460 feet long, a mere baby in comparison, and also less poetic. It is the concrete dam that withstands the Barossa Reservoir in South Australia. For some reason, the dam was built to be a precise arc. This vast grey slab of concrete has turned into an unlikely tourist attraction, with visitors chatting with each other from opposite ends of the dam. This wall does not focus sound as happens with elliptical ceilings and domes. The listener and speaker are too far from the focal point of the arc. What happens is that the sound hugs the inside of the concrete wall and is transported with surprising loudness to the other side of the dam. Whispering arches behave in a similar way, and they also show up in the most unlikely of places. On the lower level of Grand Central Terminal in New York City, outside the famous Oyster Bar and restaurant, sweeping tiled archways, designed by Raphael Gustavino and his son in 1913, support the ceiling. If you whisper into one side of the arch, the sound follows the curve of the tiled ceiling before coming back down the other side. For the best effect, the whisperer and listener need to get close to the stone, like naughty children standing in opposite corners of a classroom. This scene does not immediately make me think of marriage proposals, but still the location is a popular place for popping the question. The jazz musician Charles Mingus was supposed to have done so there. The sound effect has also inspired literature and films. The author, Catherine Marsh, uses the Whispering Arches as the starting point in her children's books, The Night Tourist and The Twilight Prisoner, describing the arches as one of the coolest places in New York. I have found a dozen documented cases of Whispering Arches. Very few, if any, seem to have been designed for their sonic quirkiness. The arch in St. Louis Union Station, Missouri, is adorned with a plaque that begins, "The Whispering Arch, an architectural accident or the sharer of secrets?" A curious question, since presumably it could be both. Apparently, the sound effect was discovered in the 1890s when, as the plaque says, a workman dropped a hammer on one side of the arch, and a painter on the other side, nearly 40 feet, 12 meters away, heard him. This whispering arch was thus an accident of geometry. No doubt there are many other whispering arches to be found. Elaborate architraves around doorways that contain sweeping arcs help channel sound from one side to another. Acoustician and Mayan pyramid expert David Lubman measured one in Westchester University in Pennsylvania. The doorway had an arc rather like a piece of upside-down, bent guttering within which sound propagates. People are so used to hearing sound becoming quieter as they get farther away that they find whispers emerging from the half-pipe of the arch surprisingly loud. Lubman wonders whether this whispering feature was deliberate, because the half-pipe that carries the sound seems to have little other purpose. But it may just have arisen by accident, a byproduct of the door design. Sadly, the feature is largely ruined by traffic noise. My favourite whispering arch is at the ancient monastic site of Clonmacnois in County Offaly, Ireland. How can a collector of sonic wonders resist that name? An ornate Gothic doorway dating to the 15th century has carvings of Saints Francis, Patrick, and Dominic above and opens into the roofless remnants of the cathedral. Like the Oyster Bar archway in Grand Central Terminal, it is a popular spot for wedding proposals. Folklore has it that the doorway once had a very unusual use. Lepers would stand at one side of the doorway and whisper their sins into the half-pipe in the architrave. The priest would stand at the other side of the arch, far enough away to avoid infection, listening to the confession emerging from the architrave. I spent an afternoon watching busloads of foreigners having fun whispering in the arch, despite rain and howling winds. How do these whispering arches work? They behave like whispering galleries. The Whispering Gallery of St. Paul's Cathedral in London gave me, as a young teenager on a scout trip, one of my first acoustic memories. The cathedral is built in the shape of a cross, with the dome rising above the intersection between the arms. It is such an important landmark of London that, during the Blitz in World War II, Prime Minister Winston Churchill ordered it to be protected at all costs to boost morale. Visitors climb 259 steps from the main cathedral floor up to the base of the dome, and then emerge onto a narrow floor only a couple of yards wide, running around the inside of the dome's circular walls. At this point, the dome has a diameter of 33 meters, 108 feet. Metal railings line the inside edge of the gallery to keep people from falling off, as they look up to the top of the dome, or down to the cathedral's floor while admiring the opulent splendor. I remember having great fun calling out to friends around the dome. It was busy and noisy, yet I could still hear my friends' rude whispers carry a remarkable distance. Whispering galleries have fascinated many famous scientists, such as Astronomer Royal George Airy, best known for his work on planetary science and optics. In 1871, he published a theory of how whispering galleries work, but it explains what happens only in perfectly spherical rooms, such as the Maparium. The Nobel Prize-winning physicist Lord Rayleigh was also intrigued, writing that Airy's explanation is not the true one for St. Paul's. To prove his point, Rayleigh made a scale model of a whispering gallery from a semicircular strip of zinc, 3.6 meters, 12 feet long. He used a bird call whistle at one end to produce a chirp skimming along the inside of the metal strip. At the other end, the sound was remarkably strong, powerful enough to make a flame flicker. But when a narrow barrier was placed anywhere along the inside wall of the zinc strip, the flame remained undisturbed. This result showed that the sound waves were hugging the inside surface of the curved strip. Sound clinging to and following the inside of the gallery walls is a pleasing scientific finding, but that alone does not explain the startling effect of the whispering gallery. Visitors often hear peculiar sounds, as reported by C.V. Raman in his 1922 paper. In response to ordinary conversation, strange, weird sounds and mocking whispers emanate from the wall around. Loud laughter is answered by a score of friends safely ensconced behind the plaster. The slightest whisper is heard from side to side, and a conversation may be easily carried on across the diameter of the dome, in the lowest undertone, by simply talking to the wall, out of which the answering voice appears to come. The sound hugging the wall creates an aural illusion because it is much louder than expected. In addition, both whisperer and listener need to get close to the wall. When listeners move their ear a short distance away from the wall, the sound suddenly gets much quieter. When the brain tries to work out how far away a sound source is, it uses loudness as a clue. Normally, whispers are loud only when you are close to the talker. Furthermore, only when a source is close by does the loudness decrease rapidly with small movements of the head. The brain misinterprets the rapid quieting of the whispers as the ear moves away from the wall, and it thinks the source must be in the stonework. Raman received a Nobel Prize for his work on light scattering, but he also carried out extensive research in acoustics. In the early 20th century, he documented 5 different whispering galleries in India, including the vast 17th century Gol Gumbaz mausoleum in Bijapur. From the outside, Gol Gumbaz is an imposing building, testifying to the power of the Adil Shahi dynasty. It rises impressively from the surrounding plain. It looks like a giant cube, with slender octagonal turrets in the corners and a vast dome nearly 38 meters, 125 feet in diameter on top, some 30 meters, 100 feet from the floor. In the words of the acoustic engineer Arjen van der Schroot, "If you walk into the place, the internal size of it is humbling, but you soon forget because you'll be taken by the acoustics as soon as you start making sound. The reverberation in Gol Gumbaz is so staggering that Indian people travel for days just to hear it. And when they arrive, they find 100 people inside screaming at the top of their lungs." With children enjoying yelling and listening as their voices repeat over and over again, the atmosphere is like a crowded day at a swimming pool. Van der Schroot was carrying out acoustic measurements and so had the rare pleasure of enjoying the mausoleum when empty. It took us 2 years to get the proper permissions and clearing the place for a couple of hours. Busloads of people were held at the gate so we could do our work in silence in the astonishing whispering gallery, where, when it is silent, you can count 10 echoes to your whisper. As much pleasure as Gol Gumbaz gives its visitors, the whispering gallery was an accident of design. The decision to put a dome on top of the hall was made only after building had begun. I can find evidence of only one whispering gallery constructed deliberately. According to a 1924 edition of Through the Ages magazine, the whispering gallery in the Missouri state capital, Jefferson City, 1917, was carefully, mathematically laid out by a celebrated expert on acoustics, and this is undoubtedly the first time on record that such a thing has been done successfully. For an acoustics conference, I produced some animations of how sound waves move around a whispering gallery. Using the latest algorithms on a fast computer, the movie showed how whispers are carried around by hugging the walls. In an idle moment while preparing my talk, I dashed over to the library to borrow a copy of the 19th century acoustic Bible, The Theory of Sound, by Lord Rayleigh, which, remarkably, he wrote while recovering from rheumatic fever in Egypt. His description of how whispering galleries work is simple to sketch out, much easier than using my complex computer models. Imagine cueing a ball on a circular pool table so that it goes off almost parallel to the sidewall. The ball then maps out how sound moves around the gallery when someone whispers along the wall. An unexpected effect becomes apparent. The ball hugs the wall, circulating close to the curve without ever going into the middle of the circle. The same thing happens with sound in a whispering gallery. When I visited the listening station at Teufelsberg, I demonstrated the whispering gallery effect to my tour guide, Martin. He had encouraged others to try out the acoustics in the center of the room, but was unaware that the voices could skim around the edges. Later, in brief moments when the ray dome was empty, I made a measurement by bursting a balloon on one side of the dome while my sound recorder was balanced next to the wall on the other. With such a loud bang, the sound can make many circuits around the edge of the dome before dying away to silence. For one burst, I counted 8 clear bangs. A plot from one of the recordings shows 4 or 5 spikes at times when the bang passes the microphone. But why is St. Paul's a whispering gallery and not a speaking gallery? I recently returned to the cathedral and made some covert recordings. The gallery is best visited early in the day, when there are not too many other people making noise. It is also best visited with a friend who can do the whispering, but I was on my own. Fortunately, the attendant was particularly adept at producing just the right whispers. Back in my laboratory, I analyzed the recordings, which showed one good reason for whispering rather than talking normally. The background noise leaking up from the main floor of the cathedral is quite loud across the bandwidth of normal speech. But in the higher frequencies at which the attendant was whispering, the background noise is much quieter, so the ghostly sounds are not swamped by the background hubbub. Most of the large sonic wonders that I have discovered were accidental, but what sounds could be made if we really tried? What shapes could exploit the physics found in accidental sonic wonders to create new oral effects? One could take inspiration from the 17th century Jesuit scholar Athanasius Kircher. In addition to writing about the infamous cat piano, he imagined and drew fantastical acoustic contraptions, such as speaking statues and a music-making ark to mechanize music composition. Perhaps modern inventors should come up with contemporary versions of these sketches. While traveling the world looking for sonic wonders, I have begun dreaming up a few of my own. Investigating the distortions from the spherical ray dome in Teufelsberg made me think of a fairground years ago when I played with funhouse mirrors. One was curved in a way that turned me into a distorted goblin. Another was bent differently, creating a disfiguring reflection that stretched out my legs so that my torso almost disappeared. Could I design a whispering gallery using a complex curve? Such a design would be new. The whispering galleries and walls I have discovered have all been simple arcs, curves, or domes. In his paper on whispering galleries, physicist C.V. Raman describes Golgar, the old government granary in Bankipore, India. Built in 1783, it is shaped like a beehive, and at 30 meters, 100 feet high, there are great views to be seen from the top. Raman notes of the sound inside. As a whispering gallery, there is perhaps no such building in the world. The faintest whisper at one end is heard most distinctly at the other. But it was photos of the outside of the building that intrigued me. An external spiral staircase hugs the outside like an old-fashioned amusement park slide. If the outside wall of the staircase were altered to gently curve, sound could spiral up the walls of the staircase. It would be a whispering water slide to complement the whispering gallery inside. The computer program that produced animations of St. Paul's Cathedral enables me to design odd-shaped whispering galleries and test whether they will work. This is how acoustic engineering is done nowadays. Before places are built, computers are used to check whether an actor will be heard clearly by the audience or whether a public address system in a railway station will produce intelligible announcements. Thus, I turned my engineering skills and scientific knowledge on their head. Instead of designing to remove acoustic aberrations caused by curved surfaces, I used the same tools to maximize oral distortions. Some of Richard Serra's artworks in the Guggenheim Museum in Bilbao, Spain, are giant steel walls that behave like whispering walls. Taking inspiration from these works, I thought about the potential design. I wanted whispers to hug an S-shaped curve like a funhouse mirror, but unfortunately, sound does not hug a convex section. I solved this problem by forming the S-shape from 2 arcs. With that arrangement, the sound passes around the inside of the first curve and jumps the small gap separating the two sheets before skimming around the inside of the second bend to be heard by the listener as surprisingly loud. The delight in these places comes from hearing a voice carry an unexpected distance, and this effect is more dramatic if the sound is a quiet whisper to begin with. Later mathematical analysis by Lord Rayleigh suggests another reason for whispering. High frequencies, like the sibilant tones in whispers, hug the walls closer than the lower frequency sounds of normal speech. It also seems that the St. Paul's Gallery is particularly adept at transporting sound. Acousticians have attributed this feature to the slight sloping of the walls. By tilting the walls inward at the top, less sound goes upward and is lost to the top of the dome. I now had the answer for why the sewer had made my voice spiral. While the analysis by Lord Rayleigh shows that the hugging effect in whispering galleries is more pronounced for larger circles, the theory also demonstrates that the same circulating effect happens in smaller places, even tunnels only a couple of yards across. With my head close to the ceiling of the sewer, my speech simultaneously disappeared down the tunnel and skimmed and circulated around the curved walls as happens in a whispering gallery. I was not hearing an audio illusion in the sewer. The sound was genuinely spiraling.